Good morning. First case is United States v. Condon. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
May it please the court, Philip Cave and Patricia Encarnacion Miranda for appellant. I've asked to reserve 5 minutes of time if I may.
Granted.
Thank you. And before I go further, I'd like to caution you not to think about the white bear. The reason is the white bear is just not relevant to this case. And I'll explain that to you hopefully later in my argument. I've divided Bailey into two parts. And I do want to touch briefly on the first issue, and I've read Bailey. But I do want to divide it into two parts, the Carruthers part and the he should have instructed part. And I'd like just for a moment to focus on that, if there's any inclination on this court, to revisit Bailey and the underlying issues. And I appreciate that's a difficult ask on my part, but I am asking. The reason is this, and I'd like to just focus momentarily on United States versus Long, which we addressed in our brief. Long was an Army case, a published Army case, before appellant's case. Now, it has relevance in two ways, but the most important relevance for you is, and this is why I don't feel too bad in making my ask, is Long presents some evidence that a panel of members may in fact need the help of a more robust definition of what is or is not consent and incapable to consent when we're dealing with alcohol-related cases. That's the point. In other words, we make some assumptions, but we have some evidence from Long that our assumptions may not be correct. And we don't know. I mean, we don't know if there are other similar cases to Long. We don't know if Long is a complete and utter single, this may be contradictory, but anomaly. But I raise it for that reason. And I know in Long, Bailey, you talked to Requena, the Kansas case. And just as the counsel did in Bailey, I would ask you to consider the effect of SAPA training, which the jury in Kansas didn't and doesn't get. Juries don't get. In federal district court under 18 U.S.C. 2242, they don't get SAPA training. So those are the reasons I'm talking briefly to you about the first issue and Bailey. But let me move on to the second issue. The defense at trial was denied a motion to suppress by the judge. When it got time to present...
Was it a motion to suppress this, or was it a motion to suppress something else?
It was something else, Your Honor. I agree that... I apologize. Just setting up the chronology, if I may. But I agree with you completely, Your Honor. It was not specific to this issue.
Okay.
Right.
Go ahead.
I agree. So prior to presentation of Prosecution Exhibit 6, which is the video, this is when the defense raises the issue. Now, I appreciate they did not, the way I read the record, say we object on the following reasons, including a specific citation of 301. That's not the way I read the record. But I think they've sufficiently raised this as an issue to preserve it. And they did this in such a fashion that the military judge, in my view, was fully on notice of what it was he was dealing with at the time, because it's him more than perhaps counsel from either side who gets into the issue of what's the relevance, is it relevant, and then is it prejudicial or not prejudicial. And that's where he decides, without any prompting, it seems to me, from the government, it's relevant. Minimally relevant is the language he used. But he doesn't explain that. And there's nothing from the government's proffer or its argument for its admissibility that, in my view, offers any reasonable basis to admit.
Well, wasn't defense counsel ask, what are you objecting to, and they eschewed any intent to object to this, as opposed to the other matter in question?
Those kinds of comments are there, Your Honor, but I think that they're sufficient.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
Yes, I understand your point, Your Honor, but I think that there is sufficient statements from the defense at the same time that they are, in fact, objecting to the admission of that portion of the video where appellant is invoking.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am. Sorry, Judge.
That's okay. Leaving that aside, do you have any case that stands for the proposition? Do you have any case that stands for the proposition that just the introduction of this portion of the video, when no comment was made, no use was made of it by the government, constitutes reversible error of a constitutional dimension?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Cave, if I may, I'd like to turn your attention to JA 195. It goes to the point that you were just raising about what the defense was seeking.
Yeah.
So this is a quote. It said, we would prefer the members not hear the portion, the very narrow portion, where there is the indication of counsel.
Right.
In the alternative, we would just ask the court to fashion instruction to the members. So why should that not be perceived as the following? The defense says, we would prefer A, but we're fine with B. The military judge says, I'll give you B, and now on appeal, the defense is saying it's abuse of discretion, the military judge should have granted A.
I agree that's an interpretation, Your Honor. But I think it's frequent for advocates at trial to give an option to the judge on, I want this suppressed, but if you don't suppress it, this is what I would like you to do.
But isn't the language a little different than just saying the alternative? He's saying, we would prefer this, but we're willing to go with that as the curative step that could be taken.
I agree that's an interpretation, Your Honor. Yes.
In that light, is the issue of the instruction and whether further instruction was needed following the introduction of the evidence, is that fairly within the granted issue, the assigned specified issue here? In other words, where are we in terms of considering, okay, if we were to conclude that admissibility is the primary focus of that issue, does that also include the question of whether the admissibility was somehow affected by the giving or not giving of an instruction?
I agree with the second part of your question there, is that yes, then we would have to get to the instructional issue. You would have to get to the instructional issue, and I think there's a reason for that. Is the judge, prior to the playing of the video, gave a sua sponte, gave an instruction to the members, and that's at J199, in which he says, "I have a small limiting instruction." But then towards the end of that, he tells the members, you can consider everything in the video and pay attention to everything and how it relates to the case. I think what the judge does there is confuses things more than he clarifies things.
Did the government in any way, shape, or form argue that anything about the accused invocation?
Not directly. No, they did not use that word.
Did they say, well, he could tell you what really happened, but he didn't?
No.
Did they say anything like that?
Not specific and in your face, if you will. I think what they did is, however...
Something so subtle that it defies imagination?
It's not that subtle, Your Honor. But it is... you're on the right, if I may.
I'm on the right track?
Yes, ma'am. this is the white bear. But I think what they've done here is, and I think this was my argument from our brief, is they've relied on human nature. And the idea, and whether we agree or disagree, that somebody who invokes must be guilty, or somebody who invokes who must be hiding something, or similar along those lines, the way the government argued this case and the choice of their language and their focus on his lies, right, that's what they characterized everything, that, and the way they argued it, draws in and allows the members to remember and infer that, as the judge told them, that there must be something bad about the appellant's explanation of things that contributes to their credibility determination that he was lying to the investigators and therefore lying to them. Those are the inferences, at least that's my view.
Well, could you connect the assertion of false exculpatory statements to the presentation of information about the rights warning? What's the linkage that you draw there?
Actually, there is no linkage. It should have no relevance. It should have no linkage at all.
No, I understand that, but for purposes of your argument, how does the presentation of an argument at trial on false exculpatory statements draw upon or be accelerated by the presentation of the rights warnings?
Because of the manner in which it occurred, you have his initial denials, if you will, and then the change, and that's what allows the members to, it's an inference, it's a smell, actually. It's the smell, the idea, culturally people think of the idea that if you invoke, you're guilty. If you invoke, you're hiding something. If you invoke, what you say afterwards is a lie.
But then he uninvoked. So they got to see that too. He uninvoked. So the inference then now he's going to tell the truth. He's going to come clean and tell the truth.
Plus, he provided an explanation for why he invoked. He said he was concerned that the general was going to watch the videotape. So how does this really have a negative effect on your client?
I agree with both of you, if I may, that those are certainly arguments and interpretations that can be made, yes. But I think the whole idea, one of the reasons we try to protect against 301, for example, and Doyle and all the other cases, I think one of the reasons we try to protect against this is because we have a fair understanding of how people in society view an accused, a suspect, who's invoking, that it has an adverse view. Members who might say, if I didn't, I wouldn't do this.
I thought that the reason that we had the rule was so that the government couldn't get up and argue, you know, the reason he's exactly what has been argued in cases where the Supreme Court's overruled it, right, where they've said, right, he could tell you, but he's not. He knows everything, but he's not. You know, the fact,
right,
that he's not telling you,
right,
is because he's guilty, guilty, guilty.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's the reason,
sure,
for the rule, is,
yep,
to keep, protect people's right to remain silent without it being used against them as substantive evidence of their guilt.
I agree with Your Honor, and I do give the government credit in this case that they didn't actually argue it during their findings argument.
Well, if they had, I think we'd all agree that it would be a very different case, right? But you are sort of in a difficult position of having to make a very uphill battle, both with respect to Bailey and with respect to the facts that are actually in the case. I appreciate your candor.
This sounds like an excuse. No, I won't say this. My time is almost up. I'm fine at that. I'd like to hear from the government, frankly, at this point, if I may, and unless you have other questions.
Thank you,
Mr.
Perry.
Because my time is up. Thanks.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Kubler, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge did not err in refusing to give a defense-requested instruction of incapable of consenting, because the requested instruction was an incorrect statement of the law. And as this court recently recognized in Bailey, the military judge had no sua sponte duty to instruct on the definition of incapable of consenting. Further, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in admitting appellant's invocation of the right to counsel because the evidence was not presented as substantive evidence of appellant's guilt, and the military judge gave a proper limiting instruction.
Was not presented as what?
Substantive evidence of appellant's
Thank you.
Guilt. And so I'd like to start with the second issue first here. And I want to make the government's position very clear. Trial counsel needs to be cautious when attempting to put this type of evidence in evidence of an invocation of the right to counsel.
And the military judge needs to be very careful when it comes to the invocation of the right to counsel.
Absolutely, Judge Olson. And we are not advocating here that trial counsel make this a regular thing that they try to do.
So would you agree that it would have been better for the government to, that it would have been a better practice for the government to have spliced or diced or done something to edit this portion out of the video?
I agree. That is the safest way to avoid any type of appellate issue in this case. But if we look at the facts and circumstances of this case, the military judge's decision to allow this evidence in the context that he did was not an abuse of discretion. And I think if you look at the federal case law on this matter, admission of this evidence very often is not reversible error and very often is not considered to be error at all. And so we know in this case that the evidence was not admitted as substantive evidence of guilt. And we know that because of the military judge's instruction that specifically told the members, do not draw any adverse inference from this evidence. Do not draw any negative inference. He says it twice.
Fair enough. But then the military judge says immediately, but you can consider everything in that videotape in the course of your deliberations. So why shouldn't it be viewed as what the military judge gave with one hand, he was taking back with the other?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that that would be the member's automatic interpretation of that line. I think if you listen to everything in context, what the military judge was really saying is don't consider, or you may consider anything else, but do not take a negative inference from that. And given the fact...
Where did he say everything else?
Well, he didn't use that word, Your Honor. He didn't say
Doesn't it
say
sound a little bit
else.
More like he said, when you come to the fork in the road, go both directions?
I don't know that that would have been, if I had been in the position, or a reasonable person in the position of the members, if that would have automatically been what they took from it, especially since they were just told twice in the row, no negative inference, no adverse inference is supposed to be drawn. And I think especially when you couple with that with the fact that the issue absolutely did not come up again. The trial counsel did not attempt to exploit it. They put one of the agents on the stand, and they didn't ask any of the type of pointed questions about that particular part of the interview. And so I believe that we have to believe that the members followed the instruction twice not to take any adverse inference from what was said.
And what's more sneaky looking, snipping it out and then telling the members there's something here you can't see, or running it by and saying, members, disregard this, he has an absolute right to do this, and then problematically saying, I mean, I'm kind of, that leaves me kind of in the middle. because they both are problematic. So you're the military judge. You've got to do something.
Well, I agree with that, Your Honor, and I think you have to look at specifically what defense counsel asked for. And if you look on at JA at 195, it sounds like the only thing that they were asking to be redacted was the invocation itself, because they say, well, we have no problem with, I guess, the part that's the small gap in time before there was some continuing discussion in the reapproach. They said, we had no problem with that part of it. So in the context of what defense counsel is asking for, which is just to excise that invocation of rights and then to have the reapproach still in there, it is going to be confusing to the members. And based on what specifically the defense counsel was asking for, the remedy that the military judge came up with was not an abuse of discretion, especially also when we consider that defense counsel, we would prefer this, as Judge Olson, as you were pointing out, it was that we would prefer this, but in the alternative, we would request an instruction. And after the military judge gave his instruction, he gave defense counsel the opportunity to submit something in writing, and the defense counsel didn't do so, which is a good indication that defense counsel found the instruction that the military judge gave to be adequate in this case. He was certainly given, trial defense counsel in this case, was certainly given many opportunities to provide an alternate instruction. I mean, if you look at the record, the military judge says, I'm going to be sending instructions out every day to look at for comments. And simply,
defense counsel simply could have said, I don't want to highlight this problem again because it is such a problem.
No, absolutely. And I think if we look at one of the circuit cases, the 11th Circuit case in United States v. Stubbs, there was a situation where an invocation of rights came up and the military judge, it was a regular civilian judge in that case, but the government asked for instruction and the civilian judge said, I don't want to highlight this anymore. And there was no abuse of discretion or there was no error found by the 11th Circuit in that particular case.
Do we have any idea in this case why the military judge made the decision that he made beforehand, before the information came in, that is, in rejecting the defense request? What specifically did the military judge say? Did he say this is bad for the defense? Did he say this is confusing to the members? What's the specific reason we have from the judge about not excising the words that the defense requested?
Well, he said it was confusion. He said that if we're going to have to start cutting up the video, then I'm going to have to give an instruction to the members not to speculate on what they heard, and it was just going to be cleaner to give the instruction and tell them not even to consider.
But why would that really be cleaner? If the military judge were to simply instruct the panel members that both parties and I as the military judge have agreed upon certain edits to this videotape because we've concluded they're not relevant to your deliberations. Why would that have been a big deal? There already were parts where the trial counsel fast-forwarded through gaps. So why would that, instead of making it appear as if it's some great concern, why wouldn't that have been an easy solution?
Well, Your Honor, I think we have to look at the timing. Although the military judge does not specifically mention this in his ruling, you have to look at the timing of when the objection came. It came after the video had already been admitted into evidence. Trial counsel was getting ready to play it for the members. So you're talking about a time situation where you would have to stop the
trial.
That's
kind of a tough argument when it comes to the rights of an accused, arguably constitutional rights, to say, gee, we're going to have to take a little bit of time here.
Well, and I think that that sort of gets to the timely objection and the waiver argument, which I don't want to get too much into that because I'd like to focus more on the
Well, before you leave that, do you waive something if you don't bring it up until the last minute? Is there a last-minute rule here where you can't bring up a request for an instruction or an objection? Just because you're only focusing on it right beforehand may not be a great trial tactic, may not endear you to the judge, but is there a legal consequence to a last-minute concern?
I don't think there is any specific case law that would support that it absolutely is waiver, but I think it absolutely weighs into considering whether or not the military judge abused his discretion in coming up with the remedy that he did. And so we have to look at it. Yes.
And along those lines, in terms of, like, what he chose to do, wasn't that the alternative thing that the defense asked him to do?
I absolutely agree with that, Judge Ryan. He was giving the defense one of the things that they asked for. And again, when you look at the fact that after he made his ruling, he asked the defense if they had anything more to say on it. They didn't. And defense did not make any type of strong argument for one remedy over the other.
Did they object to the instruction that he gave?
No, they did not, Your Honor. And again, they had the opportunity to request further instruction. The military judge invited them to submit instructions, and there's nothing on the record to show that they ever did that. And so to go back to Your Honor's points, there definitely were different options that the military judge had, but I don't think if we look at the entire context of what happened, we can say that what the military did was clearly unreasonable or arbitrary or fanciful, and so it simply does not amount to an abuse of discretion.
So in using that language, do you think this was, in getting to harmlessness, is this a constitutional issue?
I don't think it's a constitutional issue.
Why is that?
Because I think the evidence very clearly was not admitted as substantive evidence of guilt. And if we look at Doyle and Hale, which are the cases that MRE 301F2 is based upon, and if we look at those Supreme Court cases and their progeny, and even if we look at what this court has said in cases such as Gilley and Moran, really the focus of when there's a constitutional violation is when you are taking this evidence and you're using it as substantive evidence of guilt. And it wasn't here. It was just part of the context, offered as part of the context of the entire video. The military judge specifically told the members, you will not consider it as you won't take any adverse inference from this particular evidence. Trial counsel did not further highlight the evidence through presentation of any of their witnesses. Trial counsel did not argue this issue. It simply was part of a two-hour video. The instruction came before the members even had time to process that information. So it wasn't one of those situations where we see in a lot of the other cases where a witness is up on the stand and trial counsel asks the question and the witness blurts it out, and so the members hear it and they're thinking, oh, he invoked his rights. I mean, it didn't happen in that context. The members were given a lens.
So if we were to find it was an abuse of discretion, it would just be harmlessness, not harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard we would apply.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
I'm asking.
Yes, it would be a regular harmlessness standard because there was not a constitutional error in this case.
Is the pivot point here solely whether the prosecution expressly sought to exploit the invocation, or is it whether the panel could have reasonably concluded, or not reasonably concluded, from the invocation something substantive about the case? In other words, suppose we were to conclude, and I'm not asking you to concede this, that the invocation did provide a substantive indication that they could consider on the merits of the findings. Would the absence of further exploitation by the prosecution in the case be determinative, or is it simply a factor to take into account?
I think it's a factor to take into account, but I think it's a very strong factor that weighs in favor of the government in this case. If there hadn't been an instruction in this case, then I think that this court probably should be pretty worried about the inference that might be drawn. But I still think that in the context of the fact that it came in this absolute mountain of evidence. This is a long trial. I mean, we have like an 1,800 page transcript. It was a minute part of the evidence that came in. And trial counsel did not attempt to exploit it. I think there are a lot of factors to consider, but I think that the fact that trial counsel did not use this evidence further is very, very strong evidence that this evidence, when it was admitted, would not have violated 403 And certainly, even if it had been error to admit it, it would not have been prejudicial.
If you could turn to, the, unless there are further questions on this issue, turning to the first issue, one of the issues in this case is whether it's governed by Bailey or distinguished from Bailey on the looking at the fact that instructions were given as opposed to the question of whether instructions need to be given on the issue of capability. So did the judge correctly describe the issue of and completely describe the standard of law on the issue of capability here?
Well, the one term that was defined by the military judge was impairment. And so I think it's really important to recognize that the defense requested that definition of impairment. There's nothing in the record to suggest that the military judge would have used that instruction if the defense had not asked for it. And it was certainly a fair definition of what impairment meant.
Did the defense ask for that instruction, or did the defense ask for an instruction in which that definition was a component of the instruction they asked for, but not the complete?
Yes, they asked for an instruction that contained three sentences. The first sentence was a definition of impairment. The next two instructions, or the next two sentences, were not ultimately given by the military judge and focused on the definition of incapable. And so I think it's important to point out, though, that the defense did not lodge any objection to the definition of impairment staying in there.
And where did the judge provide then the completeness of that instruction requested by the defense? Assuming that the defense instruction was either incorrect or something that the judge did not have to give that way, once the judge opened up the issue on impairment, where did the judge then provide a sufficient definition on incapability so that impairment would be put into the context of the statute?
Well, I think it was in the elements of the offense, where the elements of the offense told the members that the impairment essentially has to be to the level of making someone incapable of consenting. So, and I think that is directly in line with the way the parties in this case argued the issue. No one was arguing that simply being impaired was enough to meet the elements in this case. What the parties were arguing is that it has to be a level of impairment. You have to have a certain level of impairment that renders you incapable of consenting. And if we look at what trial counsel was highlighting during closing argument, it was certainly the actions of Special Agent AD, the fact that she was asleep, or the fact that she was passing out, the fact that she wasn't even aware that appellant had left, the fact that she woke up with semen residue on her stomach and completely naked with no covers on. Those are the type of things that tend to show an extreme level of intoxication or extreme level of impairment. And so when we couple the way that this case was argued with the fact that it was the defense themselves that asked for the definition of impairment, there simply isn't any error in this case. And if we look at Bailey should govern as to whether or not it was appropriate to provide a definition of incapable of consenting. And it simply was not required in this case. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Please do.
The military judge did not err either by declining to define incapable of consenting or by admitting evidence that appellant briefly invoked the right to counsel. We respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
In 1863, Dostoevsky wrote, "Try to pose for yourself this task, not to think of a polar bear, and you will see that the cursed thing will come to mind every minute." This led to Daniel Wegener's ironic process theory, which developed from that. It's referenced in our brief, And the bluff is this. If you tell someone not to think about something, if you tell them not to consider it, they spend an awful lot of time thinking about it. That's the problem with these members being told that appellant invoked. It intrudes.
But the defense asked for it. It says, we would just ask the court to fashion instruction to the members. So how can you now argue that they shouldn't have spoken about the white bear when the defense counsel asked for a white bear instruction?
So, Your Honor, because I'm taking a different view of the ask, I think what they did is what most trial practitioners do. I'm not here as a witness, but I do it all the time. I make a motion or a motion in limine, and I ask for alternatives, and I give them the judge a list of alternatives. If you don't do this, then do this. If you don't do this, then do this. That's how I, with respect, Your Honor, that's how I interpret it.
But if you're asking in the alternative for the white bear instruction,
right,
how is it an abuse of discretion for the military judge to give the white bear instruction?
Because ultimately he did, in this case. And that goes to Judge Efron's question about the instruction, because, yes, he gave, in my view, and perhaps the court's, a somewhat ambiguous, unhelpful preliminary instruction before the video was played, but then he didn't follow up on his promise to tell the members more clearly in his written findings.
But that seems to cut against what you're saying. Now you're looking, you're saying, don't want to highlight it, but now you're saying, but then the military judge didn't give an additional instruction.
Well, yeah, are you saying, is your position suddenly now that he did it wrong? He gave the brown bear?
I mean, Judge Olson. I mean, that's the problem, sir, when you have constitutional rights defined as a negative.
Right.
You know, and therefore, in order to exercise the right, you're exercising a negative. And unfortunately, it's been that way since the Fifth Amendment. So
we're all stuck
with it.
I respect all of that, Your Honors, and I'm trying to deal with the question I've been presented with.
Okay, tell me about the brown bear.
I'm trying to address it in what I think, as an advocate for the appellant, how he was prejudiced here. And this is... And people have heard me talk about the skunk in the jury box all the time, right? You throw the skunk in and tell the jury, don't remember it. Don't smell it. That's what happens here.
Mr. Cave, you're not suggesting that this inference, once raised, can never be expunged, are you? In other words, once your skunk analogy kind of brought this question to my mind.
Yeah.
You're saying that once the skunk is thrown out there, the damage is done. It can never be undone.
Well, if I may, having lived in Ohio and run over a lot of skunks, the smell stays around an awful lot of time, Your Honor.
Counsel, I think that your argument, and I hate to beat the white bear or the brown bear or the skunk, but the problem, as I see it, is that no use was made of this. I mean, I would agree with you if the judge had given that instruction and the government had made any use of his invocation whatsoever, right? But they didn't.
I myself give the government credit that they didn't argue it. As I was reading the record of trial and reading their closing their argument, I was waiting for it, and I didn't find it, and I give them credit for it, Your Honor. But that only answers part of the problem. The part is, and it,
well,
what it would have done
well,
is...
Well, it answers the substantive use of the invocation.
I agree.
I think you agreed earlier on that there is no case that would support the proposition that you're arguing for here today.
I agree.
Correctly.
I have to agree, Your Honor. And if I may, Your Honor, Pope at 69 MJ, I think page 334, may help answer the is this a constitutional issue or not. And Judge Efron, I'm not sure if I completely answered your instruction bit, but the judge did promise to give an instruction. He didn't. I'm putting this all on the government. This is another case where the defense is required to police the government. And this is more of a my time's up.
You may finish your thought.
May I? Yeah, may I?
This is more of a philosophical argument on my part, is how the courts deal with things. And I appreciate Article 59. I appreciate courts have a role, but why are we police? Why is the defense required to police the government so much?
Counsel,
and that's, I'll move on, sir.
If I may, and this goes back to the question I asked at the outset. Specified issue in this case does not ask, and I believe the that's not before the court right now, does not ask whether the instruction was correct or whether the judge asked or whether the parties asked for something to be done later. It's whether the judge erred in admitting the invocation and that the instructional matter is pertinent in that context to whether there is any consequence to the error.
Right, the harm. Right.
As opposed to whether the instruction itself was an error or should have been cleaned up later by further instructions. Is that where this case stands right now?
No, I agree with you. The instruction issue, which I raised myself, I think, in the brief, is a collateral issue to the...
Well, how is that so? Right. If the instruction was the alternative that the appellant offered to admission, how is it not part and parcel of whether he erred in admitting it?
Because I think that goes to the harm. I mean, we have this.
I mean, you can make that argument too. But I'm saying, if you're given two alternatives and you take one, how does that not relate directly to whether you erred in admitting it?
I can see your point, and it's the question presented to me is a difficult one that has actually, the more you think about it, the more complex and rabbit trails you can find yourself in. I don't mean to demean anything or anybody.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:25.